You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of May 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show,
from the shelter of the British flag, our cameraman in Hong Kong looks into Red China, a country of fanatical communism and of rapidly growing strength.
Today marks 50 years since the start of China's brutal cultural revolution. But why is the country's state media not reporting it? And is Donald Trump running a masterclass in how to lose friends and alienate people?
He doesn't know me, never met me, doesn't know what I'm all about. I think they're very rude statements, and frankly, tell him I will remember those statements. They're very nasty statements.
Also coming up, 100 years ago, a pair of diplomats drew straight lines on maps of the Middle East. Are they to blame for the region's current woes? And we don't like to gloat, but we said Ukraine might just win Eurovision. So could a more serious take hold the key to future success in the competition? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are the London Evening Standard's defence editor, Robert Fox, and Sebastian Borger, who is the London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung. Welcome both to the programme. Now, 50 years ago today, China's communist leader, Mao Zedong, issued a directive to eliminate his rivals, starting what became known as the Cultural Revolution. The outcome of the directive was devastating. Millions were denounced, many were murdered, and others disappeared without trace. In fact, this notoriously gruesome period of Chinese history only came to an end when Chairman Mao died 10 years later. So what do the Chinese think about it? Well, it's hard to tell, as there's been a blanket ban on covering the event in the country itself. Sebastian, the silence, do you think that means an embarrassed silence, or that actually they still are coming to terms with this?
Isn't it a bit of both? I mean, it's very difficult to tell whether they're coming to terms with it if they don't talk about it, if there's no mention of it in the public sphere, if they, you know, they talk about Donald Trump and Boris Johnson talking about Hitler, but they can't speak about their own history. That's a very, very difficult and sad state of affairs. But of course, you know, you go to Beijing and you see the big Mao picture on the Tiananmen Square, and that tells you everything you need to know about this regime.
Robert, when we look at the regime that exists today, in many ways it has, you know, clear lines running back to the regimes of that time as well. Do you think that's one of the reasons why they can't make this big break with the past?
Well, I think, as we've been hearing on the economic front, there are one or two problems around. It is quite an autocratic regime, I mean, based on a personality, although we're not getting here in the West, on the outside world, so much the bigging up of the personality of the current leader. But they are aware of that, and so that they do have this towering figure of Mao, whom I agree they cannot come to terms with. They cannot come to terms in a way of a classic Freudian displacement, because you have to remember, too, like crop failures, the Cultural Revolution came on the back of another great failure known as the Great Leap Forward. And it was the way that was perceived to be going wrong, and the troops were revolting, almost literally. People were very upset at the way the uber collectivization to produce steel, which was so bad it couldn't be sold, and so on, that you got into this cycle for all kinds of reasons of the Cultural Revolution. But it was on the back of another failure. And so it is the chapters of failure, I think, that really are playing here. And the other thing is, from start to finish, Mao had to rely on the People's Liberation Army. And the People's Liberation Army is still a factor. We don't hear nearly as much as an outsider like myself would like to hear, because it is quite clear there's a lot of reliance on its management, this enormous bureaucracy, as well as the number of people in uniform that the current Mr. Xi is very, very keen on the PLA. And for all these reasons, you don't want to deconstruct the Cultural Revolution.
Sebastian, what's fascinating is when you look across the border to Russia, it's not this exactly the same. There's a similar thing with Stalin, you know, that we know the evil that Stalin did. But again, Russians can't quite jettison everything about him because so many people kind of survived a war. They feel in part because of him that they feel that he's still part of their kind of national story in some sense. Even now, all these years later, they're still trying to make sense of this man. Is it because sometimes people do such extraordinary things for good and bad that actually the shuffling of them in being down to mere mortals who made terrible mistakes is actually quite difficult for a nation to do?
Fascinating idea. I haven't thought about that. My obvious parallel as a German is my own mass murderer, a million mass murderer of the 20th century, Adolf Hitler. And of course, the good thing about him was that he was killed himself, and that we lost the war. The Russians didn't, nor did the Chinese. Isn't that maybe part of the problem? Both of these gangsters, these mass killers, were able to die in their beds and were able to, I mean, Stalin in a way less than Mao, but were able to leave successors in place who have managed to perpetuate the personality cult.
Robert, the strange thing about this blanket ban on information in China, it must be so ineffective. We know how many people travel abroad now from China, go on their holidays, come to London, go to any city around the world. So the cutting off of information from middle-class Chinese must be an absolute failure. Again, the only people who must be removed from this process are people who are kind of the rural poor, who even maybe now don't have such access to the outside world, to the internet. And is it these people you feel in the end that it may be most concerning if they turned against the government in some sense?
The official cutoffs are pretty effective. However, we can have at one end that you expunge from public debate the anniversary of the Cultural Revolution, and you even rub out rude remarks about Chinese visitors by Her Majesty the Queen of Great Britain. And I think that there's something about that that is almost risible, because this stuff does get out. You talk about the aspirational, very highly achieving educated middle class who are flooding absolutely top-end places throughout Europe, but particularly the US. But your main point, I think, is absolutely found. I have a great friend who is, I think, a very good sinologist, because he's attractive in that he gets it across so well, John Pomfret, who worked for AP and then the Washington Post. He, by the way, he was one of the very first journalists to be kicked out after the Tiananmen manifestations in 1989, because he was down in the square and he speaks really good Chinese. Read his wonderful autobiography, one of the best working journalist accounts I've ever come across, called Chinese Lessons. He went as a student to mainstream universities in China, age 19. He got there at just the right time, and he found the true legacy of the Cultural Revolution among his classmates, some of whom had had their parents strangled in front of them because they were minor officials who were then made non-persons. Your point, I think, is absolutely right, that the collective memory is a thing, I think, that even terrifies the authorities in Beijing, because they're seeing upstarts, squibs, threats. And when you're exaggerating the threat, you know that you're in trouble, whether it's bookbinders or booksellers from Hong Kong or the Uyghurs in the north, the marginalized Muslims. I think it's out there, and you're quite right, and it goes on in the folk, family, collective, clan memory. And I do think that this does mean trouble for generations of leaders to come.
Sebastian, just before we move on, when you see these bans, is it a sign of fear or strength to have such a kind of an internet ban?
People in the media overestimate our influence, to be honest. I think it works. Is it, to some extent, it's strength, and to a large extent, of course, it is weakness. I mean, we had the same, of course, we could see the same in Eastern Germany. They got, most parts of Eastern Germany got Western television, and therefore were to some extent immune to the propaganda, but it still worked. The regime stayed in place until it crumbled for economic reasons. And you can't see China crumbling for economic reasons in any time soon, I would have thought.
But it's fascinating when you think here, Robert, you know, we had a censor. We had a censor up until the 50s who decided what you could go and watch in the theatre, what could be shown in cinema. And there was real fear about lifting that censorship, the sense that, you know, people would become depraved, their morality would be let loose. And it kind of did happen in
happened.
A sense. And I was going, it did happen in a sense.
Thank goodness it happened. But I'm a child of the 60s.
But oddly, it didn't pull society down.
No, and I think I do take Sebastian's point about, I think that journalism does, is talking of Donald Trump, as we will be later, is a hugely narcissistic trade. And we do exaggerate our importance because we are becoming increasingly a commentariat rather than a reporteriat, if I can put it like that, trying to grasp the mess on the ground for what it is. But I do think it's a huge subject, this, of censorship and dissent and dissidence, because the most effective dissident, as far as the West is concerned, and the Chinese have engaged with him crudely, but I think quite intelligently, is Ai Weiwei. Mm. And they allow him partly in the tent, then they shut him up, and they allow him a certain amount of protest. It is, you know, the valve on the pressure cooker that they let off. And this is where I'm absolutely with Sebastian, uncharacteristically agreeing with almost everything
he
said.
Who knew you'd agree?
So far.
Something wrong tonight.
There's something wrong tonight. Is this regime is well in control from all the signs that I can see.
Okay, well, from one cultural revolution to another, if you thought that the Republican presidential hopeful, Donald Trump, was adopting a more conciliatory approach towards his political opponents, then think again. In an interview a little earlier today, Trump said he would struggle to work with the British Prime Minister and had some pretty stern words for the new mayor of London, Sadiq Khan. Let's have a listen.
When he won, I wished him well. Now, I don't care because he doesn't know me, never met me, doesn't know what I'm all about. I think they're very rude statements and, frankly, tell him I will remember those statements. They're very nasty statements.
Very rude. Very rude, the British Prime Minister. Sebastian, you're laughing already. Is Mr. Trump wise to take offence a minor comment like this, where he kind of, you know, he sprays the room with offensive remarks wherever he goes? He's like one of those kind of, you know, people who can dish it out but can't take it.
Isn't that that's, I think, the interesting and the serious observation of this rather hilarious episode? He displays the clear characteristics of a man who is used to getting his way, someone who is rich, who has built a business empire. You know, I've done interviews, obviously, with plenty of business people. They do not take kindly to being challenged in a really insistent kind of way, and they are always very easy he's very Trumpian to throw insults and sort of invectives against competitors, but when the same stuff comes back to them, they're all over the place. And I mean, all Sadiq Khan said was that he thought Trump Trump is ignorant, and Trump is bloody ignorant. I'm sorry. You know, you can't talk about Islam in the way that he does. And Khan also quite rightly says the way that Trump talks about Islam is a self-fulfilling prophecy, because you will get even more people tempted by extremism and radical preachers if we have people in charge of our Western democracies who talk like that about a major religion of the world.
And we should say that Mr. Trump offered to do an IQ test to prove that his, you know, views were intelligent. And Sadiq Khan was rather clever. He said, actually, it's not about intelligence. You can be super intelligent, but you can also be dumb on the subject of Islam. And that's what he was accusing, he said, Mr. Trump of. Robert, the other fascinating thing is, and if we had Mr. Trump here on a couch, I don't particularly want him on a couch, but if we had him on a couch, the other interesting thing is it hints at revenge in everything he's on. Often when he talks about, you know, it's like, I'm going to get back at you. There will be a day when I will come after you. And you don't want that from a president, do you? Someone who is riled by the most minor of comments and who feels that there's, you know, he's marking his cards until he can get back at you.
I think, as opposed to the two gentlemen he's criticised, Mr. Cameron and Mr. Khan, and I'm not going to show my political colours, but he is showing himself to be much more thin-skinned. He is showing himself to be acutely narcissistic. And I think, I mean, I know we all read our pop psychology, but the acutely narcissistic personality is a very, very dangerous one indeed. And this is worrying. And he is absolutely all over the place, as Sebastian said. And it's quite clear that the Republican hierarchy more and more are deciding to go with him because he is going to be the nominee. What are they going to build round him? Because they've got to build a team very, very quickly. And Trump's campaign, and it may prove to be the weakness correspondingly in the Clinton, Hillary Clinton campaign, is who the running mate is going to be, first of all, because the running mate is going to have to do a heck of a lot of campaigning before November. Hillary Clinton, to give her credit, the old trooper, old pro that she is in politics, recognises that. And she recognises that whoever's going to be nominated, she's put the committee forward, has to work with Bill Clinton, who will come to the fore more, and so on. But Trump's view is so extraordinary that he pretends almost as if he doesn't understand the outside world, and yet he's got big interests in Scotland and so on. He talks about this country, for example, as if he doesn't know anything about it. And he is making a ghastly mistake with Sadiq Khan. Sadiq Khan is a very, very interesting figure in the European Muslim world because he is one of the preeminent. There are others, and we know them well, thank goodness, who say that Islam, and my, as a devout Muslim, my view of Islam is compatible with the best of European Enlightenment values. Hooray! They're terribly important people. They're bridge builders. They're natural dialoguers, interlocutors. And for Trump, I don't want to be... I'm not blowing up about it, but it just is playboy bully. He's a playpen tyrant, and this is just, it's just plain silly.
And Sebastian, plain silly. But he made one other interesting point today, about the back of the queue. No one wants to be there. It's already been suggested by President Obama. That's where Britain will be if we deem to, it's wise to leave the EU. But the Germans have said, you know, it's going to be a tough time. Trump said, don't worry, you're going to be right at the front of the queue. We're always going to look after you, he says.
And I think he's done David Cameron a favour there, hasn't he? Because David Cameron can now point to the Brexiteers and say, look, your allies are Vladimir Putin, the North Korean guy whose name escapes me, and Donald Trump. Well, isn't that a great coalition of the willing?
Well, it'll make quite a nice celebratory party if it actually happens. I'm not sure who's going to be buying the drinks. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Robert Fox and Sebastian Borger. Coming up, did the actions of a pair of obscure European diplomats a century ago define the future course of the Middle East? But first this.
Being a pop star seems like a dazzling, lavish lifestyle, right? But have you ever wondered how your favourite pop song was written?
I do a lot of writing in the bath with my housemates sat on the toilet taking a photo.
Or who that song was really intended for.
Writing love songs in Spanish, I could say really pathetic, sad things, and it would be a secret from the audience and also from the person that I was writing about.
Join us on The Sessions at Midori House each week, where we bring in a wealth of musical talent to perform live for us and reveal a few truths about making music and keeping your ego under control. Well, sometimes.
I'm unconsciously comparing myself like a jackass to Paul McCartney.
From electropop to indie rock and with plenty of soul to boot, tune into The Sessions at Midori House every Saturday at 8:15 London time for lessons in stardom and a soundtrack to kickstart your weekend.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Sebastian Borger and Robert Fox. Now, the names Mark Sykes and François-Georges Picot might not mean anything to you, but the actions of the relatively unknown European diplomats may have had a significant impact on the future course of the Middle East. 100 years ago today, a secret deal between France and Britain saw the men carve up the region with straight lines on a map, many of which are still visible today. The Sykes-Picot Agreement, as it became known, has been blamed for much of the Middle East's current woes, including the war in Syria and Kurdish aspirations for an independent state. But is this being somewhat unfair to Mark Sykes and François-Georges Picot? Now, Robert, when lines get drawn on maps, sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. These were quite brutal lines in many senses, and they did divide up the world in a way that many feel didn't make much sense, especially for Syria. When you look at these lines, do you think they're still holding true today as the cause of problems?
Now, hold the wedding. Let's start talking about Sykes-Picot, which is, I've been in Gaza, but Sebastian's been in places like that, and they discover you're a Brit and people will charge after Sykes-Picot caused it. You've got to see this in its historical context and in its time. And I must say, this past week, there has been some very, very good writing about this. These were two relatively minor civil servants, and it must be said that Sir Mark Sykes, in a curious way, was a figure of genius, because probably the Arab revolt wouldn't have happened, which happened, and it was the only really moving front in the Great War, whatever you think about it, had he not been there. Famous names like Lawrence of Arabia, Gertrude Bell, the great literateur and administrator, Ronald Storrs, they're all well worth reading today, because they were set a problem in 1915, so that's 101 years ago. What on earth when we're going to do with this sprawling mess, if it happens, or sprawling mass, called the Ottoman Empire, finally comes to an end? That was the task. The lines on maps, the ethnographic lines, were not nearly as obvious as they are today, because you had the romanticism of the Bedouin of the desert, and Gertrude Bell indeed wrote a lot about it, and so did Lawrence of Arabia. There was a lot of myth-making. They were asked and they were set this task, and they drew this plan. And by the way, they drew the plan with the representative of Imperial Russia as well. Only he went home when Russia surrendered. And I don't want to go on and on and on. The problem was, this was an outline, and it was a sort of basis of negotiation at Versailles when things were settled, where people did love lines on the map, because the cry there was self-determination within national boundaries. But the fox or the whatever had gone by that time. Sykes died of Spanish influenza, so he had nothing to do with this. And most of the delegates, by the time they came to discuss the Middle East, there is ample evidence of it, were knackered, to be used common part. They were exhausted, they were fed up with the whole thing, and left so many frayed pieces. And they had to do something. So who was going to run this area? So they dished out these mandates. It was really a plan to do the mandates. It was all unfinished business all the way along the line. And as you rightly said, one of the biggest unfinished business was the Kurds. The Kurds were allowed to aspire to their own nation state. But then there was a subset to the Versailles negotiations in Sèvres, famous for the China, where a deal was struck for a Kurdish homeland, which was about as fragile, as my great friend John Randall says, as the delicate China itself. It shattered almost as soon as people went away from that, because it was in nobody's interest. It was a sort of blueprint on an absolutely crazy muddle. Because also the people within the people...
You're going to have to let Sebastian join in this conversation in a minute. We've only got 7 minutes left.
Such a pleasure listening to But may I just gently point out that he's producing a tremendous amount of fog around the sheer power politics. British and French power politics. And if you say, the Arab revolt, well, in whose favor was that? We've now had very unpleasant regimes in place held up by the British and the Americans over the last 100 years in the Arab world, which we can't really be proud of, can we?
And while we shouldn't rely on them for rational thinking, IS do claim that much of what they're trying to do is unpick this very agreement, that by forming a caliphate, they are actually drawing more sensible lines about, in a way, what should have been the division of the Middle East.
Really?
Yes, that's what they claim.
What, the coherent Arab nation? Are you saying that Moroccan Arabs and...
Hold on, you've just been called Robert Fogg, so I'm, yeah, I'm, yeah, I'm, yeah, not too... Yeah.
But the other thing that Sebastian has left out, which doesn't come into the discussion of the thing where self-interest...
Well, I
is
don't
involved,
get a word in edgeways, do I?
...is oil. You're oil. Quite right, and that's it was oil. And when you see, there are things where the skullduggery was done, which was where they placed the then-discovered oil fields of Mosul and Kirkuk, for example, and the great unresolved thing... today was Gaza.
Well, I would also point out that it was quite interesting when I looked at the agreement that originally, you were right, Russia was going to get its dibs.
Of course I'm
was
right.
Going to be given, it was going to be given Istanbul.
Yeah.
Which would have been...
Which was the aspiration from 1854 and the Dardanelles campaign.
Well, I would imagine that some of those people chugging through the Bosphorus these days have still got their eyes on that city. But we're going to move back on because we know how to back a winner here on Midori House. Last week, we were telling you how Ukraine's overtly political Eurovision entry could emerge victorious in Saturday's grand final. Here's a flavour. It could build a future where people... And so it proved to be. Jamala's 1944, which was about deportations from Ukraine under Stalin, was a surprise hit with the European public. So could this be a model for future success at Eurovision? First of all, we were just talking about cultural revolution. We were talking about the moving of borders. And whatever you think of this song, it's fascinating that somebody can go back to that time and hit a note, as it were, that still strikes with many people around Europe. Sebastian.
I'm taking my obligations to this program very, very seriously.
Well, we should point out that Germany wasn't in the top three, so we have to be careful about your opinions on
but
this.
But I must admit that I haven't actually listened to it, so I can't judge the musical value or otherwise of this song, or indeed of any other song. Yes, and it is to my great regret that I have to report that Germany came, what, third last?
So the Reds came third last.
Yeah, we were keeping you good company down at the bottom of the chart, I'm afraid.
I think there's no doubt that people around Europe, and of course you've had this marvelous Russian propaganda war over the last 2 days now, because they're very upset that the song that they apparently somehow nurtured and styled in a way that it must win, and it was indeed the favorite of the bookies here in London, that it didn't win in the end.
What was it about?
Well, no, the Russians did. Put my neck out here. I think they did have a better song. And they had a candidate who had actually kind of come out as, positive about gay rights. He had a secret porn past. What more can you want to be a pop star? Robert, the Tatars, they don't get much news of any pop songs, do they? It's quite interesting that a song about what happened to the Tatars has managed to kind of seize Europe's inspiration.
Can I say very quickly...
You're going to know some old folk song,
The Eurovision Song Contest is... to me, a complete mystery, this farrago of kitsch as to why it is given. And I think it's rather pretentious a lot of the way that it is picked up, because you've actually got your finger on it. I've been a little bit in Ukraine and a little bit in Crimea, where they have had a hell of a history, the Tatars. And actually, the majority of the people, including Ukrainians, don't care over much about it. They're much more cared about other wrongs done to them. So there's something a bit... about this.
I thought as a military historian, you'd love it. We've had Waterloo in the past. Now we've got the fight for the Tatars. It's military history brought to life.
I have to lodge an official protest against something which calls itself Eurovision and has
Australia
as one of the competitors Australia. And Australia gets, what, second place or something? Yeah. I mean, come on. There's something something seriously wrong with the whole thing.
I'm now beginning
clearly
to realise what's wrong with the editorial line in Midori House. If we take the editorial line from the lyrics of Eurovision as to what happened to the Tartars, we've got Leah Montov and really posh people like that to look at it as well.
Well, as you said, it's caused ructions in the Kremlin, people dancing in the streets in Kiev, claiming this is a kind of a breakthrough for their PR campaign about what happened to Crimea. But you'll be pleased to know we're going to have to leave it there. Robert Fox and Sebastian Borger, thank you very much for joining me here on Midori House. That's all we have time for on the show, which was produced by Rhys James, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and also by Maria Grenina. Keeping us on air was our studio manager, Kieran Matthew Banerjee. More music next, and 1900 Hours, it's Culture with Robert Bound. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 Hours London time. Midori House, well, it's back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 Hours London time. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.